Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
And good morning. My name is Dave Kubikian.
Good morning. My name is Dan Glasser.
Hi, Dan. Dan and I are two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm, and some combination of us is here every single weekend talking to you about estate planning and Medicaid planning, something called crisis planning, which we might get into today. When Dan's here, we talk about real estate, that's for darn sure. We have offices in Albany, Clifton Park, Saratoga Springs, and down in Kingston, but we cover pretty much anywhere in New York State, and it's a call-in show, which means you have to call in. And you can do so by dialing 518-476-5900, and if you don't think it's radio appropriate or it's a little too detailed, you can call us in the office, 518-465-7581. I do that all the time. Thank you, Dan, for correcting me.
You're welcome.
What's going on?
I'm really enjoying this spring weather that we're having.
The only difference is that
it's
after this spring, it ain't summer.
It's later on today, it's going to be over.
One more day.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw next week it's all in the 40s, right?
Saw possible snow.
That's all.
Next week.
That's all right. It's fine.
It's November.
It is November. Yeah, it is. You know what? It is November. You're right. Yeah. It's mid-November.
Yeah, right.
Well, so Dan, you're here. It's nice to see you.
I'm excited to be here.
If you're here, it means you're not elsewhere. Is that not right?
Wow. That was genius.
Well, I assume the kids all have activities and you said, no, I'm coming down to do radio.
That's right. Like, we have soccer. I was like, no, not today.
It's got to end at some point, right?
It doesn't. Oh. There's indoor and outdoor.
That's where they get you.
That's where they get us, yeah.
Well, so I know you've been incredibly busy, and I thought to myself earlier this year, you know, these rates are going up, and the hot market's not so hot. I'm sure Dan's going to have some free time. It doesn't look like you have a lot of free time at work.
I don't, Dave. You know, a wise man once said to me, rates don't matter as long as the house is priced right.
Who said that to you?
Oh, this attorney in my office. His name is Dave.
John, I said that about a minute and a half ago outside this office when we were talking about what we were going to talk about.
You got to give him credit, Dan.
Yeah. I do.
Okay.
Well,
there you go.
I've heard that from real estate brokers who say that, you know, there's never such a thing as a down market if you price a house appropriately, because people always need houses, or they need to move, or people, you know, pass away or different stages of life and they want to move out of the city and make a family and be in the suburbs, or they want to do the opposite or all the above, right?
That's very true. Very true. Life happens, and real estate's a part of it, and people need to, you know, upgrade, downsize.
Mm-hmm. So it's not been slow.
It hasn't been slow.
No. Tell us.
So, I mean, people are getting nervous because it has slowed down. The market that we had a year and a half ago, you know, with the COVID boom, and even earlier this year in the spring, was pretty crazy. You see multiple offers, 50,000 over asking, people waiving inspections, which I'd never recommend. No. Don't ever do it. Paying cash, you know, pulling out money from retirement just to be the one that gets the offer accepted. So I think those days are no longer here. But there are still houses being sold, more for, you know, the appraised value, people doing inspections. So,
do you think prices have gone down or they've just stabilized?
Stable, you know, and the prices are what they are. You know, what can I sell my house for is the biggest question. And the answer is whatever a buyer is willing to pay for it.
That is factually the correct answer.
Thank you. I was studying last night. So I don't try to get caught up in the hype.
Well, when it gets to you, it's already, fully baked deal. It happened. Someone agreed to buy it for X amount, and then you're involved, right?
Yeah, so I pull it out of the oven. It's cooked, ready to go. It's delicious.
Well, so you mentioned inspections, and people were waiving inspections. I assume you just get away with less now, right? So if the house has a roof issue, then it's probably going to be priced in as opposed to someone looking the other way.
Right. You know, and then the seller will say, you know, like you said, I did price it, factoring in the roof condition. Or they might just say, take it or leave it, you know.
Is there like a certain price range where it doesn't matter what the rates are, these are still selling like hotcakes? Or is it just across the board?
I think it's across the board. Doesn't really matter what the price point is. Like we said, and you said earlier, if it's priced right, it's going to sell.
Good. So where our worlds collide, aside from the fact that we share physical offices that are in the same building, is where our clients who do estate planning, who do Medicaid planning, who do trusts, and most of our clients that do trusts put real estate in. It's one of the whole purposes of the trust. Eventually, they life's going on, and they're going to do something with that property. I had a bunch of phone calls this past week where the little, description of what I'm calling about was something along the lines of selling house from trust wants to know what to do. So let's tell them what to do, Dan.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you own a house, and you and your husband own a house, it's in your names, it's titled that way. We know that if one of you passes away, it goes to the surviving spouse. We know that eventually when the surviving spouse dies, it goes as part of your estate plan. And this is if you don't have a trust. So if you have a will or if you don't have a will, there's a certain set of guidelines for where your house will go, where your property goes when you pass away. A lot of times we're encouraging people to do trusts. We'd like to avoid probate if we can. Number one, we'd like you to not die, but that we don't control that. So when, do a trust, and we can essentially take the ownership of the house, and instead of it being owned by people, it's owned by an entity, a trust. It's your trust. And it could be your revocable trust. It could be your Medicaid asset protection trust or some other kind of trust, primarily those first two. And when the dust settles, we've done the trust, we actually have a deed that transfers the house from mom and dad to their trust. That deed is recorded with the county clerk's office. The new owner of the property is the trust. Now, even though that's the case, our clients, the people who put the house into the trust, the people still living in the house, they're still responsible for all the carrying costs of the house. They're responsible for the taxes and the insurance. They're still mowing the lawn or hiring someone to mow the lawn. They're taking care of everything. Life didn't change at all. However, when you decide to maybe sell that house, it's a little different because the owner of the house, again, is not you. It's your trust. And trusts have people in charge or people who are signatories, and they're trustees. So, Dan, let's just start with the low-hanging fruit and do someone created a revocable trust. I did. I created, John and I created a revocable trust.
All right.
We're doing it for purposes of avoiding probate. We want to make sure that that property goes to our loved ones in a certain way. It's 50-50. It's this, it's that, whatever. We are the trustees. John and I are the trustees. That closing, that real estate transaction beginning to end is pretty basic because we are the ones who are using and occupying the property, and we are the ones who are signing to transfer that property to whatever buyer. So far, so good?
So far.
Okay. So on your end, you get a client, and that client's us, John and I, and you say, well, how do you have title? You're probably asking for a copy of the deed initially?
Yes.
So you see it says revocable trust. What kinds of things are already going on in your brain, in that complicated brain of yours?
Yeah, there's so much going on up there. It is who's living at the property, who's going to sign, where do they live? Because some of the trustees that we have don't live locally, and they don't want to come to the closing from Louisiana.
Okay.
So we'll...
Out of all the states you could have thought about, you thought about Louisiana.
I did.
That's interesting.
I did, yeah.
It says a lot about you.
What does it say?
I don't know. Okay, so it's a revocable charge, but are you going through the contract the same way you would if it was John and I, individuals, selling the house?
I am. I mean, the contract doesn't change. It is who's signing the paperwork at the closing. If there's an issue with the file, who am I talking to about it? The trustee or the parents? The answer there is both.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're all on the same page.
Gotcha.
So that mom and dad know what's going on.
And when it comes to, so normally a seller is going to do some sort of property disclosure. If it's a trust, how's that different?
So in New York, every seller is required to fill out a property condition disclosure statement. It's 48 questions about the nuts and bolts of the house, if they're aware of any defects, and they have the option to not fill it out.
And disclosure then, form, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then give a credit of $500. There are exceptions. Real Property Law, Section 463, by the way.
Oh, boy.
For anyone to keep.
What do we say about naming statutes on the radio, Dan?
It's very impressive.
It's frowned upon.
Oh.
It is impressive. It's also frowned upon.
I missed that memo. There are exceptions. One of them is if the property is being sold by a fiduciary of an estate or a trust. So a lot of times I get a contract, the seller is a trust, and I see a property condition disclosure, and it's like, oh, no. And then we have to get rid of that.
Gotcha. Okay. So when the actual, you know, it sounds like it's a normal contract, normal issues that come up in the process, and then we get to the closing. So John and I, the people, are not necessarily important or as important as John and I, the trustees of the trust, because that's our capacity in which we're signing to sell that house.
Hmm.
However, if I'm a buyer and a trust is the seller, regardless of the kind of trust, I need to make sure that no one is still occupying that property, right? No one wants to buy the house and then open the door and John and I are there watching football on TV still.
Louisiana game.
LSU, of course. Yeah. So there will be some documents signed at closing that are going to tell the buyer and tell their title company and tell their lender and tell the whole world that the house is being conveyed empty, without any tenancies and without any, you know, life owners, life use people involved anymore, right?
Right.
So besides that, it's basically a regular real estate deal.
It is.
Now, when we do, that's a revocable trust, pretty simple. And it should be, because revocable trusts are different versions of you. They're still under your Social Security number. There's no separate tax ID number. But when we do like a Medicaid trust, which we do a lot of, and that's why I was getting all those calls, it's really important what happens at the very end of that transaction, Dan, because at the beginning of it, it's a regular real estate deal. And, you know, in the Medicaid trust, it might be your kids that are the trustees. It might be a third party, might be a relative, a friend. They may not know the ins and outs of your property. They may not know that you know, every winter there's a little bit of moisture that is in the basement. And so to your point about the property disclosures, probably avoiding that, or lots of unknowns being circled because they don't know.
Right.
But at the closing itself, right, what was the purpose of that Medicaid trust that I had created? It wasn't just to avoid probate. It wasn't just to make life easier like that revocable trust was for John and I. If I did a Medicaid trust, the purpose was, yeah, all that stuff. Plus, I want to protect the money. Because, you know, I tell people all the time, you didn't actually put the house into the trust. You put a pile of money into the trust. It just happened to be in the form of a house. So if that property ends up selling, I need, let's go back for a moment. A revocable trust, John and I, we sell that property and we say, hey, you know what? We did pretty good on that sale. John and I decide we're going to, at the closing, take back 10 grand apiece. We just tell you, and that's what's going to happen.
All right.
Because
it's a deal.
That's us. Okay, it's all us. But if it's a Medicaid trust, it's a little more complicated because the trust says you can't just remove money. This is a Medicaid trust. What are you talking about? There's certain, you know, little rules to make sure we can protect our money while also being able to use it. So could money be pulled out of the trust if it's a Medicaid trust at closing? Yes, it could. Some of my clients this past week wanted to do that. They were selling a house. One of them in particular now is a primary resident of Florida. They still have their place up here. They're selling their place up here. They want some money out of it. They're going to go on a trip. Could I do that? And the answer was yes, even though it's a Medicaid trust, even though it's, air quotes, irrevocable, money can still be pulled out of that at that closing or thereafter, but it would be done through something called a partial revocation where we get, we could talk about that separately, but we have a piece of paper signed by all the interested parties memorializing that we're removing money from this trust. But absent that, at that closing, I need all the proceeds of the sale to go back to the trust. Why? Because we're replacing, you know, a pile of money that looked like a house with just a pile of money. We're still trying to protect all the money. And that's something that gets lost in the shuffle sometimes, particularly when, Dan, you're not the real estate attorney on the file. And if it's some other attorney, because they may say, okay, yeah, it's a regular real estate deal. The seller is my clients, right? Yeah, I'll get the trustee to sign, but if mom and dad want money back, yeah, we'll just at the closing, we'll cut them a check. Not a big deal. And that can have huge ramifications and possibly even invalidate the trust. And it certainly unprotects the money that's removed. So there's a lot of thought that goes into that.
Has that ever happened?
Oh, yeah.
To you?
A lot. It's happened quite a bit where after the fact people, you know, we tell people to come in every couple of years, and sometimes it's been 8 years. And we say, all right, do you still own this property? No. Well, where'd all the money go? Well, it's in our brokerage account. Is it in the trust? No. Well, you know, we invested it and we didn't, you know, we wanted to play with it. Whatever they want. I mean, it sounds great, but I don't know if they realize that that actually unprotected all the money that had been in that trust. And when we start to talk about look back periods and we say there's a 5-year look back period and we're in year 4, that's an issue. I have a family member right now, Dan, who is in the process of selling a house that if all goes well, the closing is going to be this coming week. The property was put into a trust 4 years ago, almost 4 years ago to the day. It's like November 19th of 2018. So almost 4 years ago. So if we do the wrong things with the proceeds, we may lose that 4 years of accrued protection towards a 5-year look back period. So the stakes are relatively high. Now, the solution's super easy. Just don't screw it up. And a lot of times when, you know, a client says, I'm thinking about selling my house that's in the trust. And it is, yes, it is them selling it even though the trust owns the property, right? It's the trustee is in charge and this and that. No. Mom and dad are the boss in our trusts. They have a legal life use in the property. The property just can't be sold unless they say so. So even though they're not the signatory of the deed, because they're not the trustee, our clients are still unbelievably important because they have this right in the trust to reside there. If the property does sell, they're thinking about selling it, I'd say to them, who are you going to use as an attorney? Do you have someone? And while you're fantastic, Dan, you're not the only great real estate attorney out there. I'm not the only great estate planning attorney out there. People could use whoever they want. But the key is, you got to make sure that they realize trusts are a little different. 95% of the process, as you just outlined, seems like it's exact same as it always would be with a couple little notes here and there about property disclosures. But the 5% that's different, if you screw that up, you just screwed up the trust. So you got to be super careful. And I'd say use Dan, but the more importantly, it's you got to use someone who's knowledgeable about these kinds of things and the little nuances. Because I think we've seen with the real estate market, with the stock market, when times are good, anyone could be good at it. But when times are mediocre or bad, you really need someone who knows what's going on. You were telling me a story the other day about a closing you had where, and I regret to say I was probably one of these people at some point, maybe not as clueless as the attorneys you dealt with. Where I don't do real estate every day, but I could do a closing, right? I could do a closing for you if you decide to go on vacation. It's not going to be as perfect as when you did the closing. You had a couple closings where the other attorney, what they say to you?
I don't do real estate. I don't know what I'm doing.
Oh, great.
Can you please help me?
Oh, great.
And this is like...
At the closing?
At the closing.
Well, no, this one was right off the rip when the contract started. I have had situations where the attorney will sit down at the table they're covering for their partner, And they'll tell me, I've never done this before.
This would be the seller's attorney or the buyer's?
It could be either one.
Well, that's true.
In that case,
matter,
that
yeah.
was the seller's.
Yeah.
That must...
It's an awkward moment.
Make you, well, you, well, it's not your job to help them through it. But I get where they're coming from because I've been asked all the time to handle stuff for family members. I'm sure you have.
I
know that you've done wills for people before. And you probably did okay with it. I don't know. Maybe you didn't, but that's not your that's not your specialty.
No.
You know, I don't know what it is about law. John, maybe you have some insight on this. For some reason, when it's law, people think you could do it all.
But, that's true. Yeah,
but when it's medicine, they never think that.
Yeah, if you're a lawyer, you it covers everything. I think that there is that perception out there.
If you're a podiatrist, they're not asking you about why their tooth hurts. Right?
No, it's just
different.
Your foot.
Just your foot.
Just your foot, yeah.
Even if your shoulder hurts, you're not asking the podiatrist.
Yeah.
But
you're right. People don't, you know, and it's understandable. I mean, you know, there are people, unless you're a lawyer, how would you really know? Now, doctors are kind of different because it's your, you know, your body. And, you know, but, it could get really in. But, I mean, Dan, you got to deal with closing companies sometimes or the bank.
Right.
Or both.
And there are
so yeah, it's it could get kind of sticky.
Oh, it can.
People will run and cry, and
there's
something
there's
doesn't go right. Right?
Emotions. There's finances.
Well, the closing process, when done right by two experienced attorneys who have done all the stuff before, issue spotted before, reviewed title insurance before. The closing should take about 45 minutes.
And it's a beautiful thing.
A beautiful 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And even when there's a lender, there's a stack of documents with the right people.
I've never seen so much paperwork on a file.
Yeah.
On a real estate file. It's incredible. My wife was a real estate person, so it's a mortgage banker, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
The paperwork is incredible.
It's insane. Yeah.
And
but
so
it's
so,
still that way.
You know, some people, well, I got to read every word, and it's like, have you seen the mortgage? Do you know how many pages that mortgage is? But you need someone who's able to explain things. You need someone who's going to walk them through it and not take forever. And when you have people who don't know what they're doing, and I've been someone who doesn't know what I'm doing before at a real estate table, it is unbelievably stressful. More importantly, it's taking way too long. Well, this check was written to the wrong payee. It's in the wrong amount. Now what are we going to do? Well, the seller wants certified funds. Can we run to the bank?
I've had those.
I guess sometimes you can do that, but not always.
So. I've had that come up where the amount's wrong, the payee is wrong. They endorse the back of the check. The check is made payable to someone else.
Hmm. Yeah.
But the buyer endorses it.
All kinds of things
can
go wrong,
So it's...
So in those in these closings this last week where they sign language to you, they wrote on a piece of paper, help. you're not explaining to their clients how things work. Are you correcting attorneys at the closing table?
I don't.
Are you sitting there thinking like that's wrong?
If they're wrong about numbers, then I'm gonna say something. I will not explain documents to someone else's client. If there's a question, I'm happy to help. But
is there a list of attorneys where if you know that this other attorney's on the other end of the deal, you're like, all right, great. This is perfect.
There is a list.
Yeah.
There is a list.
And is there the other list?
There is another list. So much
but you
like,
kind of know.
We do.
Yeah,
the statutes on the radio, you can't. I'm not going to announce that list.
I don't think you should announce the list. No. I think you should keep it to yourself. Actually.
But it is, I tell people often, I get a contract, I look to page 4, and who is the other attorney that I'm working with? And I really hope that it's someone.
Somebody you know.
Someone that I know, someone that does real estate.
Mm-hmm.
It does make for a more pleasant transaction. There are some differences with capital region contracts and those done downstate near Kingston, but to work with a real estate attorney is more enjoyable than working with a trial attorney that you can't get a hold of because they're in court all day.
Right, right. Dan, did you ever have a closing where you said, stood up and said, "We're walking"? That's it.
Oh, this is interesting. I like this.
This happens a lot.
It's happened over the years. It doesn't happen a lot to me, thankfully.
Have you ever stormed off?
You can.
We have. This is many years ago. There were issues. I'd like to tell you that I threw my hands in the air when the papers were flying, but it didn't go out like that. There was just a disagreement at the table.
Have you ever stood up and organized your papers and said, "We're done here," and walk out quietly?
I tapped them on the table.
We got a
it's
couple
the indication
minutes.
That we're getting ready. We're a little unhappy here.
We're getting close to the break here. We got a couple minutes. If you want to be a caller, it doesn't have to be about real estate. Please don't make it about real estate. In fact, let's change the topic. 518-476-5900. Dan, you'll be pleased to know that next week is webinar week.
Tell me more.
I will. So webinar week is a little truncated. It's not every single day. It's now Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of webinar week. And Tuesday, November 15th, this Tuesday, 2 p.m., we're doing a webinar about aging in place. And that's the idea that we'll cover a little bit in the second half of the show, which is getting long-term care in the comfort of your own home or wherever you're residing under a little more of your own terms. Really great webinar. On Wednesday, November 16th at 2 p.m., my favorite, your favorite, wills versus trusts, the great battle. Both accomplish the same thing sometimes. It's kind of like not having easy pass or having easy pass on the highway. Now that doesn't matter. Now they just ding you for... They bill you for tickets. I've gotten tickets where my easy pass is clearly displayed in the photo and they're trying to get an extra $50 from me.
Boy, did you ever get a bill from the Mass Turnpike? Let me tell you, they're expensive.
Yeah, well, I've gotten a bill from New Jersey, and I think they're making up for things by charging me so much. So, wills versus trusts, however, bringing it back from the easy pass. So, different ways to create your estate plan, and at what point do we go from a regular estate plan to one maybe a little more inclined with your long-term care needs. And then Thursday, November 17th, my mother's birthday. In honor of her, at 2 p.m., we will be talking about Medicaid and estate planning myths.
Can I tell you something interesting?
Yes.
Thursday is my son's birthday.
Well, in honor of him as well. You know what? In honor of my mom, we'll do the Medicaid myths. In honor of your son, it'll be the estate planning myths. We'll do it all at once.
Agreed.
Fantastic. 2 p.m. And you can register at those webinars by going to our website, herzoglaw.com. You could email us at info@herzoglaw.com. You can call our office at 518-465-7581. And we'll be right back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate and Medicaid and Real Estate Planning Hour after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston. Our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business hours Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Good morning. We're back. My name is Dave Kabakin.
My name is Dan Glasser.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dave.
In the first half hour of the show, it is the Dan and Dave show. Yeah. We actually battled to see who would get into the Olympics a long time ago.
Reebok commercials
in the 90s, and I won. Dan didn't even make it to the Olympics that year. We were talking about real estate and where... estate planning and Medicaid planning kind of intersect. Dan, I'd like to continue on that, but a little more on the estate planning Medicaid side. And I'd love to be interrupted by a caller at 518-476-5900. So we're we're often, I am often every single day, often like multiple times a day, explaining to people what Medicaid trusts do, either because we're doing an initial consult and we're seeing what makes sense for a family and do we care about long-term care and exposure and who gets what, all those good things. And then also when we're signing the trust, I'm reminding everyone, I do it Family Feud style. I say 100 people surveyed, top four answers on the board, why are we doing this? And then it's interactive and the client gets to remind each other that they're trying to avoid probate or they're trying to protect their assets, and all true. So that's why we do the trust. We want to protect our money. We want to still enjoy our money. We want our money to go to the right places and the right people. And that piece, good old-fashioned estate planning, who gets my money, when do they get it, how do they get it, that's what I want to focus on. Because when people do a trust, Dan, and they put assets into the trust, the owner of those assets is now the trust, right?
Right.
However, the way you own things, the way things are titled, is so important. Whether you have beneficiaries on assets is so important because it could actually defeat the purpose or some of the purposes of the trust. As an example, Dan, if you and your wife created a revocable trust, and the purpose of that trust is to avoid probate, and the purpose of that trust is to leave money to your children in case something happened to the two of you on date night, we want all the monies in your trust be held for your kids, give it at 22, 25, 30, this, that, whatever your plan is, right? I'm sure you have some sort of plan. The trust is supposed to make that happen. The assets in the trust should all be subject to that plan. However, if you have a beneficiary on an asset, like let's say you put life insurance into your trust, you have a policy owned by your trust now. If that policy itself has your kids as beneficiaries on it, the beneficiaries get the money. They don't get it through the trust. They get it because they're the beneficiary on something. So beneficiaries control. If you put something merely into the trust, what we're doing when we're doing a Medicaid trust is we're protecting that asset from Medicaid's look-back period. We're protecting that asset from being included as one of your resources if we need to qualify for Medicaid. The moment you die, that money's going to go somewhere. It either goes based on what the trust says or it goes based on what the asset itself says. And what I'm trying to get at is it's not enough to just put things into a trust, guys. It's not enough to just do a will. You then need to make sure that your monies go to wherever the rules are, because that's the whole point of the plan, was to leave money to your kids in trust. As an example, Dan, when we have clients that are our age, so we're in, mid-40s. Well, no, 40s. We're in the 40s.
Okay.
They have little kids. Sometimes they have six little kids, Dan. You'd never believe it.
Wow.
Yeah. Dan has six kids.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Kid you not.
I have seven grandkids, but that's kind of different.
No.
So can you imagine how many grandkids Dan's going to have?
He may have a lot of grandkids.
You may have a lot, yeah. At least a dozen or more.
Wow.
You're going to love it. Trust me. You're going to love it. Yeah, you will.
So you do, clients are our age. I'm probably not doing trust for them. They're probably just doing a basic will, right? I leave everything to my wife. If my wife predeceases, everything to my kids, and we put some rules in there about the ages and the percentages. Dan, do you have a will?
I do.
Does the will say everything to my wife?
It does.
And then says everything to the kids as follows?
It does.
Something like that?
I feel like I'm on the witness stand.
It is. Did you or did you not do a will that says your wife is... Anyway. So, you might have life insurance. I assume you do have life insurance. You better have life insurance.
Yes, sir.
Your beneficiary on the life insurance on your policy should be your wife. But your second beneficiary should not be your kids. Because if it is, then that money goes to your kids if something happened to your wife and you. And it doesn't go to your kids under the will. It doesn't go subject to the rules that you've created, that you painstakingly thought about. It just goes to the kids. Now, none of your kids are 18 years old, so it'll be, it won't just go to them immediately. There might be a guardian for that money or a custodian for that money, but that will end at age 18. And each and every one of your children will, at age 18, receive whatever portion of the life insurance they were supposed to get. And that's going to play games with their financial eligibility. That's going to play games with the rest of their lives and whether they decide to go to college or not, because they may think that X amount of dollars is they're set for life, which I don't think you ever are. So a lot of people make the mistake of, well, they do the good thing, they do it well, because they got to do it well. They get life insurance because they have to have life insurance, but they don't make them point to each other. So as a result, the will is great for money, like the house, but meanwhile, you know, and the rules holding things in trust for the kids are great, but it's just covering the house because the life insurance money is rule-free. Make sense?
It does.
So do you, honest question, I mean, you could also lie on the radio if you'd like, is the backup beneficiary of your life insurance, do you have your estate, is it the estate of Dan Glasser, your backup beneficiary?
I believe it is. Not.
It is not?
I'll have to check.
You have to check. And so people do one of two things. Well, sometimes they do the right thing. They point it to their own estate. The estate of Dan Glasser should be your backup beneficiary, right? So all the money goes to where the rules are. If you have a will as your document, if you had a trust, the trust would be the beneficiary. Sometimes people will name their kids, which I think is an awful idea. But what's even worse is sometimes they'll name their brother or their sister because that's the person who's going to be in charge of the money for the kids. Makes sense, except for the fact that you're actually disinheriting your own kids,
right?
Because you're not leaving it to them. You're leaving it to somebody else who's got their own kids, their own problems, and it's their money. And even though they ideally love their nephews and nieces, their six nephews and nieces, maybe more. They don't have a legal obligation. I want my kids to get all my money. I just want rules on that money. And there's a difference between the two. So don't name your kids if they're 5 years old. Don't name your kids if they're 12. If they're 18. I think if they're 21, don't name them as a full beneficiary. Put it in trust. Have rules, but you just got to get the money to where the rules are. So if all you do is a will, you got to point stuff to your estate. And it kind of goes against everything else we talk about because whenever Jamie and Harry and I are on the radio talking, we're saying, avoid probate, avoid the will, right? Avoid courts, avoid administrations. But for people our age with little kids, that's okay. You're likely not to both die, but stuff happens. So just in case, you know, you have a plan and all the money goes to where the rules are. Just take that same fact pattern and you have a trust. Or a Medicaid trust. You're actually, Medicaid cares about cash value of life insurance. Is your life insurance term or is there a cash value, Dan?
Cash value. Well, it's actually both.
Both. So I have a term policy. John, so I don't know if you know the difference. A term policy, so my term is 30 years, and if I survive until I think it's age 63, based on when I got it, When I turn 64, my policy doesn't mean anything anymore. It poof, vanishes because I didn't die, thankfully.
Well, wait a minute. What about all the money you put into it?
That's gone.
It's a different story.
It's gone. The money's gone in a term policy.
Okay. So.
But my premiums are really low.
Okay.
So it's not a lot of money now. If you have a policy with a cash value, you're paying a lot higher of an amount, but you're accruing some sort of benefit along the way. That cash value in Medicaid's eyes is money you can grab right now. So, Dan, if you have a policy with cash value, you can access it right now with your own signature. So that means Medicaid counts it against you when they see if you qualify for that nursing home. So what we tell people is put your policy, pick it up, and change the ownership of the life insurance and make it the trust. The new owner of that asset, just like the house's new owner was the trust, the new owner of life insurance is your trust. But then you got to just do that extra step of making sure you still didn't have some old beneficiary on the actual policy. Your trust says where money goes, but if the assets in the trust have their own beneficiaries, it won't follow the rules of the trust. It'll go straight to those beneficiaries. Dan, if you did a trust, you named me as beneficiary of your life insurance, but you named your wife as beneficiary of the trust. When you die, I get the life insurance money. It doesn't matter what the trust said because you had a beneficiary. So a little complicated to talk about. I'm moving my arms and my hands. I'm making drawings on the wall here for Dan and John, and you guys can't see it. But the idea is that you can't just have, you know what, a plan. You have to fully commit to it, and it goes beyond just signing at the table in our office to complete your will or to complete your trust. one of my clients yesterday, young family, one child, one on the way. Don't tell anyone. They haven't told anyone. So don't just keep it here between us.
Of course.
Okay?
Yeah.
But they have homework to do. Their homework is to make sure that their other assets, not their house, not their bank account, their other stuff, their retirements, their life insurance, somehow gets to where all the rules are in their trust. And we decided, let's not spend thousands of dollars on a trust right now. Let's spend hundreds on a will. Let's all not die for a while. Let's be safe out there. And then when we get older, we'll redo the documents. We'll create a trust because we're now closer to long-term care issues. We'll redo the power of attorney because now their 8-year-old is 28 and they could be our backup agent, right? Everything changes. Everyone steps up. And it just makes sense so long, Dan, as they make sure everything goes to where the rules are. It's incredibly important. We've seen plans that are wonderful plans, and then we meet with the family because someone passed away, and it turns out that there's assets owned in a way where it defeats the purpose of a lot of the plan.
Ouch.
Yeah. One of the things we do if you do a trust, guys, so if you do a Medicaid trust, here's a trivia question for you. Okay. This is fun. So one of the reasons we do a trust is to avoid probate. Probate of what? Probate of a will, right? That's what goes through probate. So we do a trust to avoid probate. Whether it's a revocable trust or a Medicaid trust, one of the things on the board in Family Feud, number two answer on the board actually is avoid probate.
Ding.
Thank you. While we're trying to avoid probate of a will, when you do a trust, you also will, I'll put in front of you a will. Why do you sign a will if one of the things we're trying to do is to avoid probate? That's the question. And I'd say take a moment to think about it, but this is radio, so give me an answer right now.
Obviously, I would have no clue.
Steve Harvey gives you like 10 seconds to figure this out.
But what do you think, Dan? Why do we still do a will when we do a trust for people? Well, I'll tell you. It's
please. To protect something.
Well, yes and no.
Yeah.
So when we do a will, for Dan has a will. He's got a will in case he dies, right? Well, we did a trust in case you die because the trust says where all the money goes and how it goes. We do wills just to make sure we didn't screw up the plan. If there's some asset Dan forgot about, if there's some asset that never went into the trust, if there's some lawsuit against a hospital or a doctor or a driver, and that's the reason why you're not here anymore, if there's asbestos litigation, if there's anything like that, we want to make sure that that money that's governed by your will, it's not in your trust. I didn't know you were going to get hit by a bus, right? We didn't assign my future lawsuit because a Greyhound bus hit me into my trust. It's governed by your will. So if your will says I give everything to my spouse and has no other rules on it, and your spouse is 85 because you both got older at the same time, well, then we have someone with a lot of money that they got from your will. That money is not protected. That money is cash money in your spouse's name, and all of a sudden we may ruin a plan. We have clients, guys, where we have a wonderful plan for mom and dad. We did a trust, you know, the laws of nature happened, and now it's just mom. Maybe mom's not doing so hot. Maybe we even got mom qualified for a nursing home and Medicaid. The plan worked, mission accomplished. And then one of the kids, while mom is still alive, predeceases her. They didn't have a will. They didn't have kids. They didn't have a spouse. Where did everything go? Went up to mom. They had a will. They did it 20 years ago. They named their parents as their beneficiary because they didn't have, you know, kids of their own. They never updated it. Where does everything go? Up to mom. Mom's in a nursing home. Bye-bye money. So,
the nursing home gets it all, right? Sort of.
They'll end up getting it.
It's a complicated question.
They'll get more than they're supposed to.
Right.
So it all kind of matters here, guys, and so you do a will even when you do a trust. We'll talk about that during Wills versus Trust. It's on Wednesday, November 16th, 2 p.m.
The day before a couple of birthdays.
Day before a couple of birthdays. So, you know, I feel like, Dan, sometimes my world, it gets a little more complicated than your world because there are these moving parts in life and death, literally life and death, and special needs, and we have to have an eye towards, you know, decades from now. But where this kind of comes back in, this was actually supposed to be my original point, the way houses are titled, the way real estate is titled, is extremely important. We have a client, an unfortunate fact pattern where, and this is, you see it every now and then, dad remarried. Dad had two sons from his first marriage. So those are the people, our clients that we're talking about. And second spouse, did some very shady things towards the end of dad's life that are very helpful to her inheritance and what she gets. And one of the things that was done was a deed transaction that she did where she moved the property that was joint to just her name. Okay, that piece of property the boys thought was supposed to be split evenly between them and their stepmom, and she redeeded it in a way where it's entirely hers. Okay, not good, right? And we, oh my God, we were all up in arms, and we said, well, there's something we could do about this if he didn't have the requisite mental capacity. If she took advantage of him, there's things you can do. The problem, though, Dan, is that when I finally saw the old deed that existed prior to wife moving it, it was titled in a way where, I'm sure that the dad didn't know this, it was titled in a way where that house was going to go to his spouse entirely. In New York, if two spouses own a piece of property, when one spouse dies, what happens to that property, Dan?
Goes to the other spouse.
Automatically. Yes. So if you have a wonderful will that says, I'm going to leave that house a third, and the will even names that property by name, right? It says the address, and it says the proceeds of this house will be sold. The proceeds will go one-third. If the deed for that property is husband and wife, when husband dies, his will is not in charge of that property. The second he passes away, that property is owned by his wife. And so she, it's funny. She did one of those things where she was going to rob a bank, and it turned out the bank was already robbed because the way things were titled previously, she was already going to be getting the property. If that makes any sense.
Of course it does.
We do have time for a caller, maybe two callers, at 518-476-5900. I can't have a radio hour with you, Dan, without talking about powers of attorney. It's literally impossible. And I just actually said it, so there you go.
That's the time.
Yeah. So we have a lot of transactions, if mom needs a nursing home, John, then that means that mom can't stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
And if
That's
mom can't
right,
stay
yeah.
at home... That means we might want to sell that house, and it might be the trust selling it. It was always in mom's name. It might be that we did something called a life estate deed a long time ago. So we need mom's signature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's in no way, shape, or form able to sign. So we'll have one of the kids sign as power of attorney.
Yep, similar to what I did with my mom. Exactly. Yeah. I got the power of attorney and moved forward from there. The house was necessary to pay for that long-term care.
Yep. So in that case, you sold it,
yes.
Sold the house, and,
yes.
and that was a arm's length transaction.
Yeah,
equally.
And it was tough. It's extremely emotional.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah, that's your family house.
Yeah.
So and sometimes you're forced to do things like that, and you can't.
Just selling it. You're going through everything. You're figuring out what to keep, what not to keep. It's difficult. Dan, when there's a power a closing where someone's signing as power of attorney. We got to make sure that power of attorney is legit, that it's still, what goes through your mind?
So if there's a power of attorney, and this happened earlier this week, I want to make sure that it's been recorded. And if it hasn't been recorded, where is the original? Because we'll need the original at time of the closing. Making sure that the principal, the person giving the power, is alive. And that the power hasn't been taken away. And there would have to be an affidavit signed at closing to that effect.
Hi, Mary Ellen.
Gotcha. It sounds like we have a couple callers coming in, Dan.
That's so exciting.
With the power of attorney, so we can actually, us attorneys could stamp something. A lot of times we're doing affidavits to say that, to best of our knowledge, it's in full force and effect.
Right.
Obviously, you mentioned the principal has to still be alive. A lot of people don't realize when you die, your power of attorney is of no longer of any force or effect at that point.
Right.
There's more recording fees because if a deed's signed through a power of attorney, right, that power of attorney has to be recorded. It's kind of part of the whole package there. And it's all about the buyer being able to, in the future, sell because they need to know that they do own everything rightfully Patty in Rotterdam's with us. Good morning, Patty. How are you? Patty's coming.
Here she comes.
Hey, Patty. What's up?
Good morning. I was wondering if you put the house, your asset, in Medicaid trust, but you end up not needing it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that trust hang in Medicaid's hands?
No.
And is there a time frame when the...
No. So you're saying you create a trust in case you need a nursing home. You never need a nursing home. Then what happens? Is that your question?
Yes. I was just wondering if there's a time frame when they'll release it. And another quick question, if you can get to it.
Sure.
If the house is in the trust, can you move money such as downsizing, and are there legal fees to do so? Thank you very much.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. Really, really good question. So let me tackle the second one first, which is, if we think about the trust as being a big circle, just draw a circle in the air and you put your house into the circle, we can play with that asset. We can, that's just money in the form of a house. That could turn into money because you sold the house. It could turn into a smaller house and some leftover money. As long as it's all happening within the circle, and we're not doing anything to pull money out of the circle inadvertently, like we talked about in the first half hour.
I'm sorry.
You can continue to protect that money. The fact that you wanted to sell your house and downsize in year three of your trust does not impact the benefit of your trust. It doesn't reset the five-year look-back period. It we're still accruing time. Okay. The first question, though, you had was, what happens if I never need Medicaid? What happens to this stuff? Well, we call it a Medicaid trust only because the rules of the trust helps you qualify for the program. The word Medicaid is actually not in the trust. It's all about the rules in the trust. So if it turns out that we don't need a nursing home or we don't need home care and we never saw that benefit of the trust, then it's no different than any other trust. Upon your passing, the assets of the trust are going to be distributed in accordance to what the trust said. If it's selling the house, the proceeds get split as follows. All good. Medicaid has nothing to do with that house. Even if we apply for Medicaid, they have nothing to do with that house. Because we're avoiding probate, it's in the trust, and it's going to follow the trust rules as to who gets what. So if you create this trust and you never need long-term care, that's fantastic. And at least we avoided probate, and it sounds like a successful plan. Thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
Appreciate it.
We have another caller, Mary Ellen in Latham. Good morning, Mary Ellen. How are you?
Hey, good morning. I'm great. How are you guys?
We're good.
Great.
What's going on?
So you're talking about real estate. Ironically, when I'm about to purchase, I hope, a mobile home within the next year for my retirement years.
Uh-huh.
It's not necessarily, some of them have titles, some of them have deeds, some of them have bill of sale, but it is, a home that I'm purchasing. So do the Medicaid rules for the Medicaid trust, does that all stay the same even if it's a mobile home on a rented piece of property?
So, yes, because what we're talking about is protecting assets. What Medicaid cares about are what can Mary Ellen, with her own signature, turn into money? What could she get to her fingertips on? So if you could sell a house, they care about it. If you could sell a mobile home, they care about it. Okay, so you're buying an asset. That asset has value. Now, what comes into play is, there's one vehicle of any value that can be exempt. So is a mobile home a vehicle? Is it not a vehicle? A lot of times our clients will take something like a mobile home. And if there's other reasons to do a trust and it all makes sense, one of the things they put into the trust will be that mobile home, just to make sure that they're protecting the asset. Because one day you may sell that mobile home and turn it into, $50,000. So we want to save that value, whether it's in the form of a mobile home, whether it's in the form of a two-family home, whether it's a raised ranch, whether it's a mobile home, whatever that asset is, we want to protect the asset. So it doesn't really change the math at all. If the math makes sense, then you put it into a trust.
Okay, Right, because, you know, the way the legal document of the sale is more like a car on some of the mobile homes than it is like a home.
Right. So how do we put it into the trust? Well, that's a difference of a deed because it's a house, or perhaps it's a bill of sale, or it's a title that we're signing over. But the purpose of it is to move value into the trust. So there's a difference between the mechanics of how to put value into the trust compared to do we put it into the trust to begin with.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call. Sounded like Mary Ellen was driving somewhere. I wonder where she is in the capital region. She could be anywhere. Or she's in Latham, so she could be driving by the studio. Who knows? It's kind of hidden. Anyway, thanks for those calls. We only have a couple minutes here, Dan. I don't know how much that you deal with clients of yours who are buyers, who are buying from a trust. I know that when there's our clients who have trusts, you're handling just about every single one of those transactions. How do you explain in a minute here to your buyers about how the selling trust works or the selling estate? I mean, I'm sure it's very upsetting for people to know they got to wait for a will to be probated so they could buy this house, and sometimes it drags on quite a bit. So how are you coaching people? Oh, 30 seconds.
Yeah, oh, boy. Wow. So I can't answer that in 30 seconds, which is now 25.
Which is now 24.
So if anyone would like an explanation, please give us a call at the office, 465-7581. I'm at extension 124.
Oh, my goodness. The extension and everything. I hope you have some good plans this weekend, Dan, with the kiddies. Probably the last weekend below or above 50 degrees.
We'll right. See. Yeah, I'm going to a soccer game after this.
Very nice. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.